not a done deal. This fight is far from over. We're also going to see lawsuits from the Free Press. We're going to see lawsuits from the ACLU. So in addition to Congress, of course, we should be fighting Congress to pass legislation to reestablish it. But there's a lot of fighting to come.
Maya Wiley, Senior Vice President for Social Justice, Professor of Public and Urban Policy at the New School. That does it for our show, Democracy Now!, produced by Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Noreen Shea, Carla Wills, Laura Gattis, Dina Sam, Malkoff, John Hamilton. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the holiday fundraiser for Portland Homeless Family Solutions on Tuesday, December 19th at the Doug Fir in Portland. Portland bands Foxy Lemon, Camp Crush, and The Get Ahead will play bluesy rock, new wave pop, and country-fied soul to benefit Portland Homeless Family Solutions, which helps families with children find housing. Again, that's a holiday fundraiser for Portland Homeless Family Solutions on Tuesday, December 19th at the Doug Fir, 830 East Burnside Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Did you know that KBOO podcasts all our news and talk shows?
You can find the podcast on KBOO's website, kboo.fm, on Google Play, iTunes, and Stitcher.
Just search for your favorite show and hit subscribe to get all the latest episodes downloaded to your favorite device.
Or search for KBOO on iTunes, Google Play to get all the KBOO podcasts.
KBOO Portland.
You are listening to KBOO Community Radio Station, and this is More Talk Radio. I'm Cecil Prescott, and I have a frequent yet important guest here. Are you an important guest?
I mean, I'm as important as anyone you have on here, Cecil.
Okay, Douglas. And well, it's important because you contribute to the community and you share knowledge and encourage community learning and education.
Well, thank you. That's a very nice thing to hear.
So if you're listening here on KBOO, please join us. Unlike last week, I'm told that our phones are working. So if you listened last week and was wondering why you just heard me go on and on, it was because we had problems with the phones, but they're working today. So our numbers here are 503-231-8187. And join us as we continue our conversation. So you're listening KBOO 90.7 Portland, 91.9 Hood River, 104.3 to the south, Corvallis, Albany, and KBOO.fm. And as part of our program this morning, we wanted to talk about this in January begins the new semester term. How do you term it?
Well, every month we have new courses. So our January term starts in January, and then we'll have brand new courses in February and March. Yeah.
Okay, great. And, well, you mentioned that because some of the courses are longer, 6 weeks or 4 weeks, so do they?
Oh, yeah, that's right, Cecil. Yeah, PUGS, Portland Underground Grad School, we've historically had courses that are 4 weeks long, but what we've discovered is people actually want to be in class longer on a particular topic. So my Reading Ta-Nehisi Coates course is going to go 6 weeks in January, And then in February, Nicole is going to be doing mass incarceration and the war on drugs for 8 weeks. Hmm. But most of our courses are 4 weeks long.
Great. And so you're doing double duty in January. So you mentioned Ta-Nehisi Coates and the other course you are preparing for?
Yeah, the other course I'm doing is Race, Big Data, and Privilege.
Excellent. Wow. Okay. Say something more about that course, Race, Big Data, and Privilege. And it's a four-week course. And tell us a little bit about the genesis or why it's important to talk about that at this point in time.
Well, what we're going to talk about in the course is structural racism. And structural racism is invisible in so many ways because it's like it's the water we live in and we're fish, right? And so we don't see it around us, and more importantly, we don't see it inside of us because it's just where we are. And so big data has been a really great opportunity to see with large numbers what structural racism is.
And big data is...
Big data is, I mean, it's been going on for a while. It's like statistical studies.
Yes.
But with the internet and the huge volume of data that happens when you see people's preferences,
yes,
you can see it in much more stark relief. People's prejudices and preferences become much, much more salient when you can aggregate data.
Yeah, I noticed in the second week you talk about preferences in terms of sexual mates or and
just
say
call
something
it
about
activity.
That. Well, sexual activity, but who you prefer to date, is that part of this?
Yeah, you know, I term it as sexual hierarchies. You know, so much of sex is about status, and it's not only humans, but it's throughout the animal kingdom, right? Like mating is about status, and in at least Western society, and I suspect all societies, so much of status is mediated through race.
Would you care to unpack status for some people who may perceive it as more of a personal politics without recognizing that for some people, status might be a very basic biological order in that my particular gene line will survive? Can you kind of unpack status just a tad?
Goodness gracious, Celeste. It sounds like you know this better than I do.
Well,
I mean, are you talking about the evolutionary standpoint? Or?
Well, not so much evolutionary standpoint, but just to kind of break it down into everyday talk, a person's going to look for a mate who can best provide for their gene line to survive. You know, do you have enough money for me and my kids to have health care? Will we have a house? Can I have some clothes? What about food? You know, can we go to good schools? You know, those kinds of things, too. I mean, the social aspect and political aspect of status, I think we all get, but sometimes we forget that we also look at it on a very basic level.
Oh, interesting. I think of it as the social aspect is the deeper level, that once you get past food and shelter, almost everything we do is about status and how we relate as social human beings to each other. We want to look good to the people we care about. And to me, that once you see that in human society, it's impossible to unsee.
Okay, I can see the convergence, but for some reason I can see the divergence too. So I'll say, okay, that's good. We'll go forward.
Love it, Celeste.
We're speaking this morning with Douglas Choi of Pugs, Portland Underground Graduate School. So just Pugs, is that?
That's right, yes. Known? Website is Pugs PDX.
Excellent. And we're speaking about a couple of courses, or well, there are many courses, but a couple of courses you'll be involved with in January. One, Race, Big Data, and Privilege, and the other on a popular public intellectual. Now, I guess he's the one to read when people are discussing.
Ta-Nehisi Coates, yes.
Yeah.
Well, in more ways than one.
Yeah, and dismissing him in a lot, but I'm sure that's be part of your cause in terms of his critics and critiques around his writing. But I want to go back briefly on race, big data, and I almost said big race.
Big race and data.
And one thing that I noted in one of the weeks, the first week you were talking about criminal law and the role of data in terms of uncovering, say, racial inequality and its use or inability to be used in the justice system. Expand a little bit about that. You mentioned something I was intrigued about, was around death sentences and the data around that. And so how is that different? Or do we use that different? Do we use that because we have those statistics now more often, and are they viable? Or do people look at, well, what's the original intent of the Constitution and dismiss those numbers?
Well, to me, this is sort of the foundational case to study race and big data. So in 1987, the Rehnquist Court, the Supreme Court, decided a case called McCleskey v. Kemp. And in it, the plaintiff was on death row, and what the plaintiff showed was there was a big statistical study that analyzed race and the death penalty, and analyzed the factor of the race of the defendant and the race of the victim. And after controlling for everything else, it showed that if you were a black defendant who was accused of murdering a white victim, you are far more likely to be condemned to the death penalty than any other combination. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think part of the sad thing is, like, I'm sure every listener sort of like nods and says, yes, of course, right? Like, this is something that is normalized, that we just understand this to be true. You don't even need a study. But the data showed it in stark relief. And so the plaintiff said, that's a violation of my Eighth Amendment right to a protection against cruel and unusual punishment, and the 14th Amendment of equal protection under the law. Yeah. And the Supreme Court decided in a hotly contested vote, 5-4, that it was not a violation of the Eighth and 14th Amendment. And legal commentators described this as maybe the worst decision of the 20th century. They say it's the Plessy versus Ferguson of the 20th century. And like sometime in the future, people are going to realize this doctrine was just really, really unjust. Mm. And the reasoning was that the defendant couldn't show that he was impacted.
As an individual.
Mm. Well, yeah. Based on what?
Well,
because there had to be some skewing of either, there had to have been some, what's the word, semantics going on, or skewing of some information presented.
Well, there is, I mean, and that's the most interesting thing about big data, just in totality. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, if you're black and you can't get a job, you can't prove you didn't get that job because you're black. And that's...
That falls under the same rubric as something I was reading recently, which is re-examining the whole idea of academic rigor as another arm of white supremacy. So, you know, okay, right. And basically, the reason you can't prove it is because the system is set up for you to have no way to prove it. That's all there is. But I got you.
Well, I would love to have a longer conversation about that. But the second thing is, essentially, the deciding opinion said that the foundational core of our justice system is the jury system. Mm-hmm. And the juries get to decide punishments. And if you take away the jury's ability to decide punishments, you destroy the core. What's so interesting is in the 1980s, they started doing mandatory sentencing, right? Yes. And quite frankly, like part of the reason was a concern for justice. We want to be race blind in our sentencing, but race blind sentencing with mandatory sentencing actually had the opposite effect on minority populations, because what it did is it transferred the discretion to the prosecutors.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, you squish one part of the problem and it just like blops somewhere
point.
Else, right?
that just bolsters my point, but yeah,
yes.
Right ahead.
But Justice William Brennan described this case as the concern for too much justice in his dissenting opinion.
Wow.
We as the Supreme Court was too afraid of the consequences of saying, yes, the statistics show that we have too much racial animus in our criminal justice system, because it would destroy the entire system.
And I assume that the Supreme Court has not re-examined that decision.
It has not.
Yeah. And so you look at this, and you look at the data as it relates to the criminal justice, as it relates to maybe in terms of sexual status and preferences, in terms of dating. And I think many of us are familiar with housing and job discrimination, about how, depending on who you are, the name, your name, that things are related to access to housing. And then on the fourth week, you have something that called a class presentations. What are these projects? Do you assume that students might bring to it, to the class? Are they bringing? I suppose it's a variety of reasons why people might enroll in the class, and they might have a concern about something, or there might be something that comes up from the class that they say, I want to examine more. What are the class presentations about, generally?
Well, this is the first time we've held a course, but this is where I'm most interested in seeing what happens with the students, because they get to choose researching a topic of their own choice and seeing how big data reveals race and privilege. I think, going back to, week one with criminal law, McKesky v. Klemp, I think one of the things, the bridge I want us to cross is, okay, it's easy to see a Supreme Court case and be upset about an abstract piece of law that happened in, that's 30 years ago,
yes.
Right? But the bridge I want to cross is, how does that affect us, like as individuals, including people who have never touched the criminal justice system? Like, how does the impact of the criminal justice system on other people privilege me? How have I benefited from this? And so that's the leap I want to make for each of these topics: the criminal justice system, dating, job discrimination, and housing discrimination. And so the week four is our presentations from the students about how race and big data have given them privilege.
And could you say again how people might enroll in the course, or if they have questions, or are there requirement prerequisites?
There are no requirements, prerequisites. The basic idea of PUGS is that everyone has a right to continue learning throughout their daily lives, their adult lives. We live in a system where there's an assumption that, like, once you finish, like, school when you're a kid, it's like you put on a suit and you never have to, like, learn anything else anymore. Or that, your knowledge and, more importantly, your ignorance is your own responsibility. There's no community responsibility for improving knowledge. So PUGS is this idea that the community can teach itself. We don't need an educational industrial complex. We just need a way for community experts to share their knowledge. And I personally believe that we're going to have a more just and connected community if we do that. So our website is pugspdx.com, or you can just Google Portland Underground Grad School. This course is on Wednesday nights at Southeast Uplift. We have six other courses or five other courses, six total in January. They're all really great. There's a big social justice theme at PUGS. And because we believe education is a human right, we have a pricing and generosity policy, which means that anyone can come to class at the wage that they earn.
Excellent. You are listening to KBOO, More Talk Radio with Celeste, and I am Cecil. For a way in which you may participate, you may give us a call, and the phones are working this week, 503-231-8187. You want to know more about these courses in particular, or PUGS generally, give a call, and Douglas is able and willing to share his knowledge and his understanding of it. And also, I don't know whether or not you write these things, but I'm told, or I've read, that a nationally renowned educated expert has called Douglas the best teacher I've ever seen teach.
Well, I did write that, but it is actually...
You're not one of those bots that the FCC is getting hit up on.
It is actually true, but I did write that.
Well, I'm going to grant you that anyway, because in the beginning you said that you're as important as anyone we've ever had on the show.
Oh, Celeste,
so, you know, I'm going to grant you that, because I agree.
And let's switch a little bit about this other course you're talking, we'll be teaching, which I'm excited to read, since Mr. Coates does not return my phone call, so it might be better.
Really, we're trying to get him on the show.
It might be better if we engage with other people who has read his works.
Well, if you ever get him on the show, you can knock me off.
Okay.
I won't be insulted.
You can get him on, and we can bring you back. I prefer that dynamic. How about that? That's a better quid pro quo. So, for first, why Mr. Coates? Why?
Well, I mean, you mentioned it earlier. Like, he's sort of a core figure. He's probably the foremost public intellectual on the topic of race.
Cecil said that.
Cecil, mm-hmm. You said that.
I'm not going to take his credit. Well,
okay. I did, but, you know. Continue, please.
I mean, essentially, he is afforded, I mean, by dint of his intellectual power, he's afforded... a voice in the country that speaks louder than anyone else. I mean, like, if, like, the National Review, the conservative publication, has to respond to Ta-Nehisi Coates, and they usually, and we'll see it in class, they usually respond with great respect.
Yes.
Like, there's no arguing there's no arguing the facts of what he presents.
Right.
And so... no matter where you are on the political spectrum, you have to deal with Ta-Nehisi Coates. And I think that's super, super important. I mean, I was not alive during James Baldwin. They say he is the heir to James Baldwin. I can't imagine James Baldwin having as big of an intellectual impact as Ta-Nehisi Coates does right now.
Yes.
But I don't know if you have any commentary on
my
that.
Only reason, if that is true, it's only because of the changes in technology. But I believe that on a popular level, James Baldwin really has provided such a broad platform, you can't even say that people are standing on his shoulders anymore. What you can say is people are standing on his in-depth critique of our racial, social, political reality.
Wow.
That's what I would say.
Wow.
You know, because Coates couldn't have stepped off without him.
Absolutely.
Well, let's go to a caller who has a question or comment for the best teacher I've ever seen teach. good morning, James.
Good morning. I wanted to, I guess this will start off slightly... like, it'll seem kind of off topic, but it'll get back to it. Got a story about that young kid, Keaton Jones, who whose mother videotaped him being, you know, he said he was bullied at school for some reason, and all these people donated like $60,000 to him, and then we found out later that his parents were like Confederate flag waving racists. And then everybody's coming in on the kid, and they're like, well, don't blame the kid for the sins of the parent. But, you know, more importantly, when it comes to big statistics and imprisonment, the children are always punished for the sins of the parents. Always. I mean, I grew up in a household where my mom had committed one felony, and she served 6 months in prison, and after that she could never find a job, and she had a hard time finding housing, and us four kids were punished for it. I mean, maybe not directly, but, you know, because of the injustices that come from being a Mexican American as well as being a convict, she could never find a job no matter how hard she turned her life around.
Yeah.
You know, and she got so depressed she ended up relapsing, which is a whole other story. But I mean, it's like she worked hard. She got her GED, she went to classes, she studied, she was clean, she was sober, she was doing everything the system told her she needed to do to be an upright citizen. But then at the end of the day, they still punished her for that thing on her record, and it gets even worse, obviously, as your skin gets darker. I mean, we've had a slightly easier time because we're white passing for the most part, but I mean, that doesn't take away from the disparities of people who have darker skin. I mean, it's even worse when you compound those things, and on top of that, you compound the fact that they want to continue charging you for the time you spent in prison, and then if you have kids, they want to lop that on. So eventually, you're working basically just to pay off the state.
Yes, certainly. Thank you, James, for sharing and putting a clear picture on the criminal justice or injustice system. In your teaching, do you examine the dimensions of the impact or on families and communities generally on the justice system we have?
Well, first of all, I'd say like everything that James says is correct. I think the criminal justice system is a way to process racial injustice. It's a machine that does it for white supremacy. That's not something that we'll be addressing very much because we only have week one to address the criminal justice system. But our 8-week course in February and March on mass incarceration and the war on drugs goes pretty in depth on that and the impact on families and the impact on communities.
Yes, I want to tackle something that James said that goes back to a statement that I made earlier about how the system is designed to obfuscate, to put a smokescreen up about how you can't prove the direct harm to yourself. Now, here you have a woman who, even though she was convicted, has done the retribution. Yes, she can't find a job. So the question is, well, how does she prove that the system is harming her? And you're saying that we don't capture that information. And I know that you only have so many weeks to tackle this, but it's kind of like a little conversational side, not a cul-de-sac, but a side here. Why is it, or is it something even deeper that we're not capturing that information? And how can we design an algorithm that will? And let that percolate in your mind, because we have a couple of the callers. And I don't think that's going to be an instant answer.
Actually, let me address that really quickly.
Okay.
I mean, in week three, we're going to be talking about job discrimination. And one of the studies we're going to be talking about is the fact that a white man with a criminal record has a better chance of getting a job than a black man without a criminal record. I mean, let that sink in for a second. But the way I interpret it is there is an assumption of criminality to blackness.
Mm-hmm. But we know that. And it was necessary for blackness to be criminalized for both slavery to work and post-slavery institutions of discrimination to work.
And so the super interesting question to me is, if you're an employer, this never goes through your head. Do you think you're giving this white guy a chance?
Do you really always think that? Or is there another overlay that prevents you maybe from even thinking that? Because I'm going to assume a lot of people, and I'm being nice, I'm assuming a lot of people are not even consciously thinking that. That sometimes they don't even think that deep, let me give this man a chance. It's like, oh, I got a hireable body.
Right. And I guess, mm-hmm. but my point is like these individual decisions of employers, you can't say this person hired that person because of race.
Right.
And that's where like we lose it. Like there is no causal connection. And so because there's no causal connection, we believe we're innocent.
I doubt that there is absolutely no causal connection, but we'll talk about that later. Because,
all right.
See, I refuse to believe that because there is a causality that's implied by the functional structure, just the functional structure alone, of white supremacy.
I can see that.
Okay, but let's get to our next person. Good morning, you're on the air.
Is that me?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Yeah, two people. Hey, good morning, guys. Listen, so just as a side note, you know, the comment about whether or not James Baldwin or Ta-Nehisi Coates is like, I hate comparisons like that. It makes it almost sound like you're discounting James Baldwin. And when you consider the time that he grew up in and
yes.
he has written about, he's a monster.
So, I'm with you. I'm like, so with you.
Yeah, so anyway, I just wanted to say that. So, but the earlier part of the program, I talked about mandatory sentencing and where you started off about Kennedy saying too much justice. You know, I mean, just the fact that they decided and he said that alone says how fearful they are of giving up the structural of what this country is based off of, because a lot of this country is the foundation is based off of racism. And that's why Howard Zinn said it perfectly. You don't go to the justice system looking for justice. You know, I mean, that what he said lines right into what Howard Zinn said. You know, and that old saying that, you know, laws don't change things. Culture does. People do, eventually. You know, how they stand up to things and so forth if you really want to find justice. So my last comment, too, is in regards to Celeste. You just a moment ago mentioned slavery. With mm-hmm. my comments is, you know, if you go back and you read Frederick Douglass's memoir on bondage, if you read so-called between the lines of everything he says about that time, the very much the politics, if you look at the way that the system is structured now, nothing has really changed when you look at who the slaveholders were and how they did it and the colonization and slavery. It's very much, if you look at it, it's very parallel to what's going on today as well.
Indeed. Nothing's changed. Thanks for your call.
Really quick, agree with everything that Sean said. Just to be clear, the speaker of the concern of too much justice was William Brennan in a dissent.
Thank you. And let's speak about, we just mentioned Ta-Nehisi Coates and his influence, and Sean also mentioned tell us about what we will be reading. And I know he's written a lot for the Atlantic magazines and a couple of best-selling books. What's the focus of the course?
Sure. We held this class 2 years ago. I taught this class 2 years ago, and it was, quite frankly, it was probably the most powerful of the experience I've had as a PUGS instructor, and I think mm-hmm. everyone in that class remembers it very, really fondly. First of all, we had the course be the students. We chose students so that half the class would be black, and half of the class would be non-black. And so the power there in and of itself, where black voices were center to the conversation, was really, really important for both the black students and for the non-black students. What we're going to be reading a collection of his essays from the Atlantic, and it'll be Sundays 10 a.m. to noon at Southeast Uplift in January, 6 weeks, and we'll be reading The Case for Reparations, which is a long seminal piece that he did almost 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And then Letter to My Son, which became Between the World and Me, which won the Pulitzer Prize. And then Black Family in the Age of Mass Incarceration will be week three, and then in the following weeks we'll be addressing Coates during the Obama years. We'll choose essays together, and then we'll move on to the Trump election and what Coates wrote about that.
Excellent. And it seems as you were very intentional in terms of, as you said, centering Black voices in that course. Will that be the same case this time around?
Yes. And so I would love to encourage anyone who's African-American who is interested in teaching or taking the course to come. Again, we have a strong scholarship policy so that whatever price you can afford, we're going to get you in.
Excellent. And that will be at Southeast Uplift?
That's right.
Sunday mornings at 10 a.m.?
That's right.
Okay. I hope you have it at another time.
I was thinking about Sunday church.
Well, it's funny. For those 4 weeks, 2 years ago, we did call it church. It felt like a spiritual experience.
Well, I'm trying to rectify church. It just like that, but I was thinking about Cecil. It'd be so cool to take it with him, but he's working then.
Well, Cecil, if you want to... I mean, we should do this off air, but if you want to teach this course sometime at a time of your choosing, you should become a Pugs instructor. I've been asking you to be Pugs instructor, both of you, for a while.
We'll have it under consideration.
All right. Yeah.
Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that there are several other courses in January. Do you want to mention them that people can choose from?
Sure. One course that KBOO listeners may be particularly interested in is hip-hop spoken word and anti-fascist activism. And that's being taught by Mike Crenshaw of KBOO. Mm-hmm. And essentially, he's going to use hip-hop and spoken word to help people find their activist voice. It's a super powerful, fun class. Like, people are going to have to, like, write hip-hop and spoken word.
Wow.
And they're going to learn how to, like, rhyme. It's actually really, really cool. And that is on Mondays at Hatch 24th and Sandy. Drawing plants, winter meditation, is about using drawing as meditative practice. And that is on Wednesday nights at the People's Food Co-op. Mm-hmm. And Melissa Melko, who is probably the highest rated Pugs instructor, will be teaching that. She's absolutely wonderful. Thursday nights is Christine Dupree's Portland's Urban Native Americans, How to Be an Ally.
Lovely.
And that's a super popular course. We've sold that course out twice. And it's extraordinarily powerful, looking at the disparities and the burdens that Portland's hidden urban Native Americans face. As a side, we're going to have Portland's African American Boys, How to Be an Ally, in February. And mm-hmm. I'm really looking forward to that course, too.
And who's teaching that class?
Justice Raji, who works for... IJC. I don't know what the acronym means, but it's going to be really wonderful.
All right.
Lastly, on Thursday nights is Thriving Through Heartbreaking Personal Change. And George Winburn is going to be talking about when a traumatic life event happens, when things fall apart, and the process of going through that. How do we use this to build resilience, strength, and blossom after that?
Wow. You know, that really should be a class taught at, I want to say, like fifth or sixth grade level for everybody. You know, because we are not understanding totally the world we live in and how it has been systematically dismantled to benefit people with privilege. And I don't mean the privilege we bandy about when we talk about grassroots level white privilege. I'm talking about real privilege, you know, making laws, making policies, creating paradigm shift privilege, you know, that kind of stuff. And so I really feel it's necessary this is how deeply I feel about it. I tell a lot of my white colleagues and friends and allies how difficult it is to be a person of color, and especially if you're African descent in this country, and you have to explain what bigotry and racism, and especially institutional racism, is to your child. And it's like trying to explain to your child that there's a molester in the family, and you cannot protect your child from that molester, and you yourself can't be protected from it. You can't even protect yourself from the molester. But please know that I love you, and even when I'm treating you really bad, it's because I'm messed up in the head from this molester and the fact that I can't protect you or me. You know, and I believe it's that kind of necessary that people learn this, because that is one of the things that keeps us caught in the smaller cogs of this systemic breakdown that we're experiencing. The kind of situation that James was explaining with his mom, you know, if some kind of way somebody had been able to take him by the hand, give him this work, he would have been able to perhaps have a deeper effect on both his own psyche and his mom's or his family's psyche, and have that positive ripple effect go out. But in the meantime, we got pugs doing that.
Well, I mean, I think this is the importance of adult learning. Like,
yeah,
you know, when we're adults, like when we go through these heartbreaking changes, and like part of it is just life, right? Like,
yeah,
forget about privilege, but like, yeah, loved ones die,
yeah,
you know, like, we get divorces, like all these things happen, and it is part of human suffering. And do we have the tools? Like, do we give people the tools to blossom out of that? And that's just a key question.
So, speaking of key questions, if you've got questions, we do have, we want to apologize, we do have the ability to have conversation, 503-231-8187, and join in the conversations. Apologies, let's get to our next caller. Good morning, Joe.
Hi, Celeste, Cecil, and your guest, whose name I think I missed in the beginning, but I am following the conversation, and I wanted to bring it back to white supremacy and how it may come up in the coursework that you teach or that others might be teaching there. And specifically, I wanted to ask about this idea that I know goes back as far as W.E. Du Bois, that white supremacy is in part a system of control over the whole population that offers a privileged position for working white people, middle-class white people, but that it's a devil's bargain, and that it's a compensation for the power structures that exist over even the whole white working class population, and how that either still holds or how we have to move past that and think in with a different analytic framework.
Yes.
I totally agree, Joe. I got an argument with that.
Yep.
Douglas?
Yeah, go ahead.
I just wanted an ending comment. So.
Yeah, I think that Joe's absolutely right. One of the things I find really interesting is, like, you know, in justice and equity work, we ask people to, like, implicitly give up privilege. And I think that's just a super, super, like, rough thing to ask, because I heard a quote recently, which I think is absolutely true. To people with privilege, equity feels like a loss.
Yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. And that makes I'm not judging that. I think that is human nature. Anything that we have that we get asked to give up, even though it was undeserved, feels like a loss. And that's everyone. And so the question that I'm trying to figure out is, how do we make a more equitable society without people feeling like they're losing? And I think that's a core question in American politics. And I don't have an answer, but my beginnings of my answer is that you have to think of it as a trade. What are we mm-hmm. trading in exchange for our privilege? And it has to be something that we want more than what privilege gives us. And the beginnings of my answer are that Americans are pretty unhappy people. Like, when you do surveys, poor people rate themselves on an average, on a scale of 1 to 5, with 3 being normal, a 2.6. They're pretty, like, they're less than happy. They're less than neutral. Mm-hmm. But you ask rich people exactly the same question, and they rate themselves 2.8. So people with privilege don't feel themselves happy anyway. So we need to construct a national narrative about how Creating a more equitable society makes us all happier. And I think there's probably a very good argument for that to be true.
Hey, Joe, thank you for your questions and comments. And I know you are part of this struggle. And I just congratulate you. And Moses Malcolm, gee, talking about liberators, that's mm-hmm. quite a legacy thank to you. Live up to.
Indeed. All I can say is...
Well, thank you, Joe. Let's go on to our next caller.
Good morning, Tim.
Hi. Hey, am I on the air now?
Yes, you are.
Okay, good. I think that last caller was right on, was spot right on. And I think the things that you guys are talking about are excellent. Also, as a way of elevating people, helping to transform their lives and open up themselves to what they can do, right? And the caller, the last caller was talking about how can we create a new paradigm, right? I think that society is already responding in that way by the movements we see popping up, right? The emergence of cooperative housing and cooperative food places and farms, all these things are popping up all over the place, but many people are left out of that, like inner city people and stuff. What we need to do is somehow bring together, coordinate these things. We need to start building an alternative so that all people don't have to go to Safeway to buy their food. They can go to a co-op that supports what we believe in, what we're trying to transform society into, that kind of stuff. We need to redirect the cash flow away from the corporations, because that will kill them. And if we can do it in a mass movement. But we need to create the alternative institutions and then coordinate them, right? And then we have the numbers and the potential to force change, right? Something along those lines.
Excellent.
And we need also, we need to coordinate racially, interracially. There's a lot of whites, people with privilege, and I've worked overseas in other cultures, and privilege doesn't just happen to land on white shoulders. It lands on the shoulders of whoever the elites are, no matter what their color, or no matter what their language. And there are some exceptions, but basically, it doesn't make a difference. There are a lot of whites and people of privilege of whatever color who are trapped, right? They want a good life, but they know that they're getting it on the backs of others, and they don't know how they can get out of it without sacrificing more than they feel they can sacrifice. And that's another reason why we need those alternative institutions. So they, along with everyone else, can get into that new paradigm. We don't want to have a paradigm that excludes one color or the other because of past sins, past guilt, whatever. We need to be united because we are brothers and sisters in the end.
Indeed.
It's only one planet, and we're one species, and we got to work out a way together, or we're all going to get screwed.
And you're so right. I can't argue. The only thing I would add is that for those who find themselves to be the recipients of privilege, and especially if you have some privilege as a person of color, your job is to help it actually trickle down, whether you volunteer somewhere, whether you teach somebody how to read, whether you teach in financial literacy, whether you go volunteer at the homeless shelter or you make sure clothes get washed, whatever you do, keep sewing it. Keep sharing it, keep passing it on in those small gestures, because those are the things that build connections and help divest power. But thank you so much for your
comment. But all people of privilege Not just people of color need to do that.
Oh, well, you're right. We're talking about those of us who find ourselves recipients. Yeah.
We don't want to be trapped, say, oh, now I have the money, so now I can help, right? So now I keep the system alive. No, man.
No.
We want a different
dismantle
system. Just system, and we need to keep focused on that, even though we're privileging off of it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, sister. Good luck.
And you are listening to KBOO. This is More Talk Radio. We're speaking with Douglas of PUGS, Portland Underground Graduate School. At 9 is the OMO Variety Hour. We'll talk about net neutrality, bye-bye, feminist politics, sexual harassment, and a look at the newly elected senator from Alabama. 10 is Locus Focus. Barbara Bernstein talks to journalists and explorer Edward Strutzig about his book, Firestorm, How Wildlife Will Shape Our Future. At 11 is Intersection Radio. Sarika talks to Nidhi Sanani about her graphic novel, Pasmina. Radio Zine presents Between the Lines, Radio News Magazine, and the world's reaction to Trump's Jerusalem Declaration. Stay tuned tonight at 5 for the evening news, in-depth segment with author Bobby Arellano and his book Habana Libre. And KBOO needs you to continue to be involved. So consider joining this radio station. Go to kboo.fm and click on donate. Right now, this is More Talk Radio with Celeste. I'm Cecil, and we're speaking with Douglas of PUGS. And I think we might have another...
We've got another couple of calls.
Callers.
Yeah. Let's get him on board. Good morning, Cody.
Good morning.
Hey.
How
are you doing?
Good. I'm doing great. How you guys doing?
Yeah. Hey, I'm doing a little better. I'm happy to be here.
My question is concerning African Americans, the vote, and the quid pro quo, and this latest action that went down in Alabama. I don't know if you guys know, but Alabama's like 29% African American. It has a 55% rate of incarceration rate of the black males. And a very interesting thing in Alabama is that in more than a few of the counties down there, they have hookworm. They're having septic issues down there. And all this basically went completely unreported and during the race. And my question is, at what point can black people in today's world, I want to say, stop having their vote ticket for granted and use it as a bargaining chip for quid pro quo and some type of restitution from the government as a result of the taxes they pay to improve their lives in a world full of white supremacy. This also goes for Flint, Michigan, another black area that has another high African American population count. But as we all know, there's also a high lead level in the water in Flint, Michigan. Any suggestions from your guests on how black people can get that word quid pro quo, sear it into their brains to such a degree where they can, you know, in our brains too. I mean, I don't want to sound special, you know.
No, I was just thinking, you asking a daunting task.
Yeah.
Let's see if he can at least get us a toehold on it.
Well, so I mean, my whole thing is the system itself is the problem. It's like trying to find change within the system is. I personally feel like that's just not the way forward. Like, I think, to me, opting out is the primary metaphor for me. Like, Black Panthers opting out, right? Like, doing self-help. Like, I'm actually super interested, like when we talk about sexual hierarchies in week two of the big data race and privilege course, like opting out of the sexual hierarchies. Like, for example, and Celeste, you probably know a ton more than me, I just know of it, like radical black lesbian politics, like opting out is like really, really a viable option, especially with the internet now, like creating your own communities outside of the system that perpetrates violence on you, your soul.
I want to preface anything that we say by saying you can create a community, but at some point that community still has to interface with that poisonous system. But the advantage of creating your own community is that you have an insulation point, and yes, you have an aggregation of energy, and so you try to use that to mitigate any damage and to increase any caregiving and well-being, but recognize that until there are enough of those created communities, you're going to still deal with the monster.
Absolutely. And I would say for listeners, they should read The Guardian this weekend, which had an article about poverty in America. 41 million yes. Americans living in poverty, 10% of our population. And the article goes into hookworm in the South.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and we're talking about third world conditions in this country.
And it took a British newspaper to report it.
Yeah, I was reading it part of it this weekend.
Right. I bring that up mainly because I'm all for self-help. Please don't misunderstand me. But there's some things that will require hundreds of millions of dollars. And I don't think a co-op can go as far as fixing an entire...
But you can't... You don't start at the top, though. Remember that. So that's why we don't worry about those hundreds of millions of dollars now.
What I'm saying is what are we do in the meantime? I mean, that hookworm is still affecting African Americans. That lead poisoning in the mm-hmm. water is still affecting African Americans.
Hey, I would say that's when you start letting people know down there what the resources are, whether they're local resources or close by resources or further away resource, and make sure that the resources know about the problem there. So it might be one of those situations where you as a knowledgeable person steps out and contacts organizations that have some power. You know, maybe we need to embarrass this country by having the World Health Organization, such as it is, you know, come in, and you know, they're not the cure, but they're somebody. You know, and you may end up having to make some of those connections yourself. You know, all of us can't grab every single problem, but the one that is igniting you is the one that you step out and you tackle.
Hey,
thank you,
Cody, so much for your
and thank
your
you for
thought.
Calling.
And we have only a couple more minutes, so I want to give Douglas the opportunity.
And we have one more caller.
Oh, one more caller. Mm-hmm. Okay. Michael.
Good morning, Michael.
Good morning. So, listening to the description of the first course that Douglas mentioned, it sounded to me like there might be this in the underlying logic of it, which is that anytime there's a disparity, that's proof of discrimination. And it seems to me like that's a rule that could go right sometimes, but it could go wrong other times. And I'm just curious what Douglas thinks about whether that's part of the underlying logic, and if so, well, what he's got to say about that.
Can you go just a little further, please?
Well, you know, like you say, for some particular category, like people who work as programmers or elementary school teachers or I don't know what, pick some category and say the racial demographic breakdown of that category doesn't match the demographics of the society as a whole, and therefore there's discrimination. That's the rule that I'm wondering if you see as part of the underlying logic or if you don't. Because that rule seems to me like it could go wrong sometimes as well as going right other times.
Yeah, I see exactly what you mean. Thank you for that, because I don't have an answer like right off the top of my head, but that's something that I'll have to think through and include in the course. Thank you.
Oh.
Okay,
and sorry for cutting you off, but we've got scant seconds. So, Douglas?
Okay, I would say like one of the interesting things But I would use precious seconds just to say, I love talking to the two of you. Like, I want to, like, hang out with you outside of, like, radio interviews. But I would use my last time just to say, like, I think underlying so much of this is money.
Well, yeah.
And what I've been thinking about recently, and why I teach financial freedom, and my next financial freedom course will be in February, is that I actually think we're facing a future where capitalism will not need humans anymore. And what happens?
Well, of course, they're already using AI for that.
Exactly. So what happens in a post-job future to us, and the opportunities and the potential disasters, I think, is a question that we have to address at some point, and neither political party is.
Well, that's because they want us to stay stupid. But you can be smarter if you listen to and support your community connection, KBOO Portland. So do it. KBOO.fm for more information. Connection is our idea of community. Catch you later.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. The December 18th meeting of the Board of Directors will be held at 6 p.m. at Cider Riot, 807 Northeast Cooch Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm/board-directors.
Did you know that KBOO's daily evening newscast is produced by a team of volunteers right here in our Portland studios? If you've got some extra time and would like to get free training in radio news production, come on down to the studio and get involved. You can learn interviewing, writing, editing, and production skills, all for free, in a fun and supportive environment. Call KBOO's volunteer coordinator, Ani Haynes, at 503-231-8032 to get involved. That number again is 503-231-8032 to volunteer with the KBOO Evening News.
This is Jeremy Scahill, author of Dirty Wars, and you're listening to KBOO, Portland.